Our reading today comes from the Reverend Karen Herring, and it's entitled Oriented Times Three. The first time I saw the phrase Oriented Times Three, I was working in a hospital as a chaplain. The phrase was used frequently in patient charts, and at first I thought it might be shorthand for an extremely oriented patient, like being oriented to the third power or being uber-oriented. I imagined a patient who was aware on many levels, quick, sharp, responsive, cognizant of what was going on inside of her and around her. And then a nurse explained to me that the phrase refers to being oriented to person, place, and time, a determination commonly made by asking patients, "What is your name? Do you know where you are? Do you know what day it is?" And I began to wonder if we might ask similar questions to determine if a person is oriented spiritually. What would it mean to be spiritually oriented times three? What questions might we ask to determine that? What is your name? Do you know who you are? Do you know whose you are? Do you know where you are? What is your place in the world, in your life, in your relationships? What day is it today? What time is it in your life? What is it time for? What are you living for today, tomorrow, yesterday? These are not unrelated to other questions I ask all the time in hospital rooms, in the pulpit on Sundays, or in long nights when I am alone. What do I believe? Where do I belong? What does it all mean? Certainly, I know the questions better than the answers, but I also know this. We all have spiritual compasses inside us that help us to arrive at our own answers. Sometimes we can read our compasses more easily than others, but we all have something that spins towards north, an inner tug toward the holy. And in those times when our compass is impossible to find or to read, or when it points in a direction we don't want to go, we can turn to one another, or to maps that help us to get oriented, or to the constellations that guide us where we're headed. Perhaps this is what it means to be spiritually oriented times three, oriented to self, oriented to others, and oriented to the holy. Perhaps this is what we're doing here together, reading our compasses, finding our way in a universe of shining stars, and making new maps to help one another.
Hi. I wrote this piece back in the summer of 2005, when I was pursuing my master's degree in music education at UW Oshkosh. And I was taking a course in composition and was assigned to write three pieces for my choirs for the following fall. And one of the pieces was to find some poetry that was in the public domain. So I did some study and I found this poem by Walt Whitman, A Noiseless Patient Spider. And you'll find the text, the poem itself, in your order of service. And I was doing some research on it, because when I read the poem, I found it very powerful and very beautiful, very moving. And I went online and checked out some poetry chat rooms and salons that were on the internet, and the overwhelming response to this piece of poetry was, "Oh my God, this is the most depressing thing I've ever read." And my reaction was, really? I mean, when I read it, I thought it was gorgeous. I thought I found it so powerful. So I did look, and it has been treated, you know, as a choral piece several times in the past 50 years, and they're all very pretty and almost too pretty, as if to kind of like avoid what could potentially be a rather dark message in there. But I don't find the message dark at all, and decided to meet that mystery head on. So if nothing else, think of this as maybe a soundtrack to while you lie on your back and look at the stars.
Our voice was offer the choir my great thanks because they have, this is the fourth service that they've now done, and so that's quite a commitment, and thanks to Jay for writing that beautiful song and for sharing it with us today. So our message today is, what is my place in this vast cosmos? Maybe it could better be asked, what is my place in this vast cosmos? Well, considering what we know about the mind-boggling, imagination-jolting expanse of the universe and all that has been reasonably speculated, the only logical answer to that question of what is my place in the cosmos is that of a speck. A superlatively minute speck riding on an only slightly larger speck through an ocean of sky hurling through space, the vastness of which is truly, truly beyond our comprehension. To set the stage and to give us just a little bit of a reference point about how enormous all this is, I'm going to borrow liberally from a videographer what he posted on YouTube. It takes us on a chronological journey out into space, traveling at the speed of light. The link for that video is listed on your This Week at the Fellowship. It's the first resource link under the Joys and Concerns there. So you can go out to the internet and find it if you'd like. You can also come on Wednesday to our Wellspring conversation because we'll show the video first and then have a group conversation about it. But either way, I want to offer this one little caveat that as the videographer takes you out in great, great images through this journey, he ends with a comment about the creator of such a marvel. I, as you might imagine, would much rather savor the mystery than assign an architect or an initiator to it all. So come with me now. Let's take this quixotic moment to allow the imagery of this very true story to sink in just a bit as I relate to you some of the markers that he highlighted on this galactic journey pictured so dramatically in that video. Suppose, if you will, suppose that we embark on January 1st at midnight and we are traveling away from this home of ours that we call the planet Earth. Suppose we are traveling at the speed of light, which is a little bit over 186,000 miles per second. We would pass our moon in 1.3 seconds. We would fly by our associate nearby planets so rapidly that they would be behind us in less than 10 minutes, actually 8 minutes and 19 seconds. We would then encounter the sun. But our fantastic journey does not stop there. If we continued on, we would eventually pass the erstwhile planet Pluto. That's a bummer about Pluto not being a planet anymore. So remember that this hypothetical journey commenced at midnight on January 1st. We passed the sun then at 12:08 a.m. We would pass Pluto at about 5:30 a.m. on that same day. And if we then chose to veer into a path that was perpendicular to our solar system and to continue on at the speed of light, years would pass before we would reach the next nearest star, about 4 1/3 years, and we would have by that time traveled 25 trillion miles. In our cosmic journey so far, it took us just 5.5 hours to reach the edge of our solar system, between 4 and 5 years to reach the next nearest star. And on we go. It would take us 100,000 years at that pace to get enough distance to recognize the swirling, gauzy arms of our Milky Way. 5 million years to see that our galaxy is part of a cluster of what astronomers call the 30 local galaxies, each with billions of planets of their own. And at the 50 million mark of our travel, we would spy another cluster of about 2,000 galaxies. And on we would travel galactic cluster after galactic cluster until 10 billion light years away, there would come into view a spellbinding pattern, woven threads of space and matter that dance and swirl through the ether every moment around us, every single moment. This is going on without our conscious knowledge whatsoever. Most of us hold no awareness at all of all of that activity beyond measure, but it is going on just as surely as our snow is melting, just as surely as our gas prices are going up. This is the stuff of which we are made. Every single distant advance up that cosmic ladder, at each new level of observation, we encountered more and more and astronomically more. All parts of this fantastic web of existence of which we are a part. This is the unfathomable material of all that has ever come into being. Each breath we take, we inhale the substance of that incalculable universe. Multiple billions of years, trillions of miles, countless, circling, glowing, spinning, pockmarked, gas-hovering extraterrestrial bodies. And when we pause to let our minds rest in the magnitude of it all, doesn't it seem so amazing that we walk around here every day feeling so distressingly, so urgently, the ebbs and flows of our tiny little life on this tiny little world? Everything here seems so crucially, so gut-wrenchingly important. It calls to mind for me the story with the simple but exquisite images, this book, The Little Prince by Antoine Saint-Exupéry. The images that he draws here are just so great. If you haven't gotten this book down for a while, I would encourage you to take it out and just read through it again. It's such a delightful story. And he's drawn, as you can see, this little guy who in most of his travels has a scarf around his neck and his hair is flowing. And he stops at one planet after another, trying to make sense of what he experiences, trying to learn from others about the bonds of beauty and of love. And sometimes it seems like we're just like the characters in that little book. Do you remember there was the businessman who was so busy with all of his calculations that he couldn't pause long enough to see the little guy in front of him? There was the drunkard who was too caught up in trying to forget that he effectively forgot to see. There was the king so focused on commanding and controlling one thing after another that he failed to realize that he was foolishly alone and that in fact he was ruling over nothing. We let ourselves forget that we are just this radically minute bit on a nearly imperceptible dot of a planet floating in a universe of mystery and grace and the enormity of the unknown. It's a far more wild ride than we let reach our consciousness most of the time. But when we allow it to sink in, when we remember this whirling stage upon which we so precariously stand, we realize that our life dramas are, in the grand scheme of things, barely more consequential than an anthill getting flooded by the rain, or that spider diligently casting its gossamer threads. In fact, in relative terms, our lives are much closer in size to that ant and that spider than we are to all that ceaseless whirling activity spinning, floating around us every day out in the galaxies. And we somehow forget and we ignore that cosmic dance of which we are surely a part. And we forget and we forget and we forget. And we believe that somehow when we hurriedly glance up at the dark night sky, we somehow unconsciously imagine that it's just a painted backdrop of glittery scenery given to us for our viewing pleasure. Without knowing it, we treat that mass of mystery as if it is a twinkling stage offered just for our aesthetic enjoyment. And we miss that it holds infinite messages about our meaning and our mortality. And those messages come from so far beyond that we can't even begin to fathom all that is outside of this little existence of ours. Carl Sagan said it very, very well when he wrote in his book Cosmos, "Who are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than there are people." And are we so small of imagination or so full of hubris to pretend that we, who live on this insignificant planet of a humdrum star lost in a tucked away galaxy, that we are alone in all of this astonishing, ephemeral scaffolding of time and space? Just a few weeks back, scientists announced that the Kepler telescope has provided better data than they ever had before. And this has heightened some of the intriguing possibilities, confirmed some of the guesses that they previously had, upped the numbers of what they already expected. So they now project that there are at least 50 billion planets in our Milky Way. And of those, at least 500 million have the potential mix of elements where life could exist. Oh, that's just our galaxy. There are more than 100 billion other galaxies so far. So how can we attend to numbers like that? And how can we then cling to our human conceit that all of this sublime glory is ours alone? We don't know, of course, but when looking at this magnificence, even given our puny powers of reasoning, the odds would seem to indicate that it is quite unlikely that we inhabitants of this earth are truly the highest and only level of cognizant life that has ever formed anywhere. Our smallness and the inconsequential nature of our little earth-bound existence, when contemplating the clusters of galaxies billions of miles away, should certainly deflate our human-centric egos in a flash. It might, in fact, reduce us to a place of feeling as if nothing matters. We are so very tiny. We are so lacking in significance in the grand scheme of things. Why not just give up? Why the heck are we all working so hard, scurrying like that spider, casting and casting our threads, frustrating and ceaseless strivings for excellence and growth and meaning? What on earth does it all matter? And that, for me, is the point. For what we know is that it does matter on Earth. It may not matter in that galaxy that is trillions of light years away from us. Our place in the cosmos may be so minuscule that from that perspective it's barely worth nodding at. But in undeniably real terms, as far as we know, this is all we've got. This is all we have access to. So we better make good use of it. These numbers and measurements of time and space that we've been talking about are really too big for us to manage. The human brain evolved in a way that permits us to process the information that we're going to need, and it seems that the evolutionary mechanisms didn't really see much need for us to comprehend numbers that have that many zeros after them or distances that are that far past our line of vision. But it's kind of a shame, it seems, because if perhaps we could absorb it all better, maybe we would be more apt to take the time to stand dumbfounded before the power of it all. Now, those of us who have walked at the edge of the Grand Canyon know that feeling of being awe-stricken. It's similar to the whispered, humbled reverence that we feel as we're dwarfed by the huge sequoia tree. But honestly, as gigantic as those things seem to us, by cosmic standards, we know that they're peanuts. They're way less than peanuts. They're not even a particle of dust. So what is my place in the cosmos? It is here and it is now. We are not the exploding galaxies, nor are we the toiling spiders. We are not the molten sun, nor are we the squirming sea urchin. We are not the skeletal remains of some ancient coyote, nor are we the asteroid on a collision path with Mars, but we are of a certainty connected with all of that. We are people, human beings, who are fortunate enough to be residing on this spinning blue ball, breathing in and out, having thoughts and gestures and feelings on the day that we call March 6th, 2011. This is our home. This is our life. Now, I do wish that the modern human species felt compelled to spend more time in awe of that night sky. We just don't do it often enough. If you are like me and my family, it generally takes us to the time when we have to go away on vacation, when we're away from the city lights and distance from the cacophony of sounds, and we find ourselves standing under that blanket of dark, that sparkling canopy, and we are swept with that calm delight as those feelings of peaceful astonishment overtake us. For me, those nights when it is so crystal clear and so very present that it feels like you could actually reach up and cup one of those glistening stars as it hangs in the black emptiness. Those moments melt my heart like no other. They make me know that of course, I am nothing. And yet, I am everything. Both are true, nothing and everything. I am wondrously and completely a part of all of that infinitude. In this astonishingly massive universe of ours, out of the profound greatness beyond our perceptions, there are sounds and movements and patterns far, far outside our ability to even imagine them. It's so easy to understand why people felt that they had no choice except to make up words like omnipotent and supreme and almighty when they were struggling to somehow fathom how all of that unfathomableness came into being. And I have a notion that if we did genuinely ponder that brilliantly poignant night sky more often, there would be more gentleness. There would be more peace in our world. The inescapable humility that that vision inspires might help us to know far better that raising a gun or raising a fist in order to plant our personal flag in some patch of dust is really quite pointless. That owning land and owning stuff matters so little when viewed in the magnitude of light years. All we really have is the experience of this day, of this moment, of this now. So I like to think about how indescribably enormous the universe is because it leaves me no choice but to come back to what is right in and around me in this here and now. A few years ago in St. Louis, I had the great joy of hearing the very gifted poet Mary Oliver speak at our General Assembly. And if you know Mary Oliver, you know that her language choices are just amazing, razor sharp. She is so, so, so skilled at taking just a handful of words and sketching an amazing picture. She was asked to explain how she prepares to write the way that she does. And she took just a flash of a moment to think before she responded. And she said that she pays attention fervently to everything. The quote that I jotted in my little notebook, she went on to say, to pay attention, this is our endless and proper work. As we bathe ourselves in the awareness of how inconsequential we are and our earth are, may we also know that this earth, as inconsequential as it may be, is all we have. This life, this existence, these relationships surrounding us today, this fellowship, this house, this job, these kids, these friends, may we not squander our nows in the obtuse behavior similar to those folks that the little prince encountered in his galactic journey. May we instead commit ourselves to paying attention. May we, like Mary Oliver, see that as our endless and proper work. And when I am fully paying attention to life, I remember in my soul's greatest depth that I am both nothing and that I am everything, that I am the stuff of the stars and I am the dust of the earth. The published subtext for this month's theme has to do with both looking at our place in the cosmos and also what that might tell us about building a better world. That's what we'll be dealing with in our Wellspring Wednesdays through this month. That's what our coming-of-age youth are talking about this month. I think you know me well enough to know that I am all about building a better world. But as I've had the luxury over the past couple of days to just linger over images of comets and galaxies to try to contemplate that great out there, it occurs to me that perhaps a starting place to building a better world is first to rest in deep appreciation for the one that we've got. This world, this existence, this life of ours is nothing short of miraculous. The cosmic expanse is so much more than we can attain to, but even so, it is no less miraculous, and in fact, it is the very same flow and substance that makes up our daily existence here and now. Yes, I feel inclined to bow to the unspeakable majesty of the interstellar miracles that surround us, but equally so, to the coming of spring, to the cardinal's song, to the tender tear that fills a loved one's eye. Life, cosmic and earthly, life is a miracle that is ours to experience and to appreciate, that we are a part of all of it, no less and no more important than those exploding distant stars. To close, I invite you to read with me the beautiful piece. It's number 445 in the back of our hymnals. It's a responsive reading, and it pretty much sums up everything I've just said. The womb of stars embraces us. Remnants of their fiery furnaces pulse through our veins. We are of the earth. We breathe and live in the breath of ancient plants and beasts. Our fingers trace the curves carved in clay and stone by forebears unknown to us. We gather anew this day to celebrate our common heritage. May we know and believe that it is our endless and proper work to pay attention. Amen.